anti-SLAPP legislation allows a judge to take a fairly cursory look at a case and determine, yeah, this has merit, it could go either way, or no, this is just someone being a bully. And if it's someone being a bully, we're going to shut this thing down now. We're not going to wait until this kind of wins its way through the court process. So that was the attempt that Global made, and to say they weren't successful would be a bit of an understatement, I think.
Yes, the anti-SLAPP legislation. Basically, this is applicable to Ontario and BC, which have near identical laws. The key passage of Justice Parel's decision, or maybe one of the key passages as related to the SLAPP test, is that, you know, in the immediate case, in my opinion, there is little public interest in protecting the defendant's expression from the scrutiny of a defamation trial. In the immediate case, freedom of expression on a matter of public interest is advanced, not curtailed, by allowing Dong's defamation action to proceed in order to test the righteousness of Global News' revelations about Dong's communications with the Chinese. It is a matter of considerable public interest that there be a defamation trial. If it is true that Dong assisted the Chinese government and thereby betrayed the electorate and the two Michaels, then he should be disgraced. If it is not true that Dong disgraced himself, then it is of considerable public interest that he vindicate himself, because the Canadian public is not in favor of baseless character and career assassination and irresponsible news reporting. Dong may be a villain, or he may be an innocent. The defendants may have outed a villain and be lauded for it, or they may have wrongfully accused an innocent man, and if so, they should be embarrassed and they should pay reparations. One side or the other will be vindicated, he continues, and it is in the public interest to have that determined and not decided on technical grounds pursuant to the anti-SLAPP legislation. That actually part is actually the relatively even-handed part, because elsewhere in the analysis, as much as I like talking about the various tests that are involved, a lot of it comes down to a judge assessing, based on what's before them, if this were to go to a full trial, what is the plausible range of outcomes that a judge at trial could arrive at? And Justice Parel, in this case, took the opportunity to very bluntly say it is quite conceivable that a judge at trial would... Was it too much to say offended or outraged by what he sees as the lack of responsibility in the reporting?
I'm going to suggest that that may take it too far, okay, because Parel is also pretty cautious about saying that he's making this determination on a limited record, mm-hmm, and that he understands there will be so much more evidence. But you're right. Based on what he does have before him, he's not terribly impressed with what he's seeing. But this, we can't overread this, because all Parel had to do was to say, I think when the whole case is before a trial judge, it's entirely plausible that this could go either way. So it's not a slam dunk one way or the other. And once Parel saw that, he was fairly confident. And then the other part that Parel points out that is just so plainly true is he says, this is not a slap suit. Again, remember, slap suit protects little guy from big guy. There's not a clear David and Goliath relationship here. In fact, one of the first times we ever started talking about what eventually became slap suits anywhere in the Western world involved protesters, I think, in the 1980s in the famous McLibel case, which was a couple of unemployed activists with placards complaining about McDonald's. Two little guys against a giant multinational with a Hamburglar behind it. That is considered kind of classic slap, kind of power imbalance, little guy versus big guy. We don't have that here. And also, slap suits require that the litigation is launched for an improper purpose, like I said, to stifle free expression, to get people to stop pamphleting the neighborhood. Here, it's pretty clear that an MP's reputation has been left pretty torn apart by this. So the stated purpose, which is reputational repair, is clearly the purpose here. And Parel was really, really unflinching on that point.
The legislation is also written in a way that something doesn't have to strictly be a slap suit in order to be dismissed under this legislation. So sometimes judges will, or often they will, weigh in about, like, I think this is a slap, or I think this is not a slap. But that's just one factor, and it more comes down to the series of tests of basically of whether the defendant has or does not have a valid defense, or whether that what would happen at trial, as well as generally the balance of protecting the expression versus protecting the person's right to vindicate their own reputation. Dong has always emphatically denied the allegations, and in response to this ruling, released a statement continuing his call for Global to apologize and retract the Two Michael story, saying, quote, I've been clear from the beginning. I never advocated or supported in any way the violation of the basic human rights and continued wrongful detention of Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig. The accusations made by Global News are false. End quote. And Global, for its part, told the Canadian press and other outlets, while we are disappointed in the decision, we are encouraged by the recognition of foreign government interference as a matter of public interest in Justice Parel's ruling. End quote. What stuck out most to you about this decision?
What stuck out most for me was, if we want to get into the kind of factual matrix of this, one of the things is Perel's comments about the lack of evidence that can be produced in court. Mm-hmm. So he's critical of Sam Cooper and the fact that what this whole story is, hangs on, and I'll quote, is multi-degree hearsay of a translated phone conversation. So let's really factually just kind of fill that in. This all goes down to a conversation that Han Dong had with an official in the Chinese consulate. And what it appears that Cooper and the other defendants do not have is any kind of tangible evidence of that phone call, because that phone call was conducted in Mandarin. There was some kind of readout or summary produced. Mm-hmm. The confidential sources, and that's also an interesting part of this, the confidential sources have access to that, but the evidence before us tells us that Cooper doesn't have that to bring to the court. Cooper did not see that. So the judge is saying this is kind of a tenuous kind of point-to-point-to-point state of relationship. This is, there's no smoking gun that Cooper or Global has in its hands here. And the judge is pretty clear on that fact. So it does speak just how solid that evidence may be or may not be. But there is, since you like the tests, Jonathan, there is the responsible communication defense that could be applied against this at some point.
Mm-hmm. But to get back at Jay, I think that's the question of the documentary evidence. I mean, something that I think it came out shortly after this Global story was originally published. The Globe said, slipped in a passage in one of their stories, like, we had also heard this too, but we chose not to run with it because we weren't able to independently verify it, and was later elaborated, yeah, they couldn't get them their own hands on the documents or an audio recording to independently check it, and so decided not to run with it. There's the question of, I guess, the journalistic ethics, or at least the, not ethics so much as the diligence and responsibility, and what degree is necessary. And Global clearly believed that having two independent sources who they had already had, otherwise who definitely had confidence in, they felt that that met the test of a meeting of basically of it being publishable or potentially publishable. What Cooper explained in his cross-examination was that, well, his understanding at the time was that the Globe and Mail had had one source, whereas he had two, and that's why he ran it, and they did not. Having one single source tell you something explosive is, especially when it will do harm to a specific individual entity, that's generally not the thing that you could run with unless you're able to independently verify it. Is there a number of sources that would be more, obviously more sources the better, but what do you think about like a two-source story for something explosive like this?
We often hear as a general rule, or I've said as a general rule in journalism, that two independent sources is the minimum required. So that's what we're up against. In so many contexts, those two independent sources will be enough to kind of get the rubber stamp of, yeah, this is good investigative journalism. In this case, the stakes are so high that if it were my newsroom, I'm not convinced that two independent sources is sufficient, just because of the nature of the allegations. And, you know, the question of whether or not more reporting could have provided a better evidentiary foundation if more time had been taken. Because, again, that's also something that a trial judge will look into if and when this goes to trial. And that is just, was there a time-sensitive nature here? Was there time to investigate out this story a little bit further? So I don't know if two is really cutting it here. Back to this whole idea of what we owe someone before, we as journalists owe someone before we're about to drop. And boy, this terminology is something. Quickly, let's go back to the judge's decision. He says, it's unclear whether the defendants exercised the appropriate level of investigation before dropping a cluster bomb on Dong's reputation. Okay, so the word is in journalism. If you are about to drop a cluster bomb on someone's reputation, you need to, one, describe that cluster bomb in a pretty fulsome way, and two, give people time to flee the scene, come up with an explanation, whatever it takes. Without a very specific unpacking in that email to Dong that says, you know, part of this story is going to say that you made comments that deliberately led to kind of the slow walking of the two Michaels to being freed. That is key to what we call the sting of the defamation, okay, that you stopped people from being freed when they never should have been incarcerated in the first place. Big deal. So if that is missing, that is the first real gap here. And it appears that that is missing. We also know the more explosive the allegation, the more the law tells us we need people to take the time to sort this out. And then the other part that I think is also worth unpacking for a non-journalism audience is it might not be as telling as I first imagined it was when I read that the defendant's notes didn't necessarily have all the important elements. Journalists who deal with confidential sources have to sort out their own way of kind of doing their job professionally. And for some, the belief is that it's just plain stupid, like dead stupid, to put critical details in notes that can then in fact be ordered through production orders in court. So this may not be an indication of sloppy practice. This may just be one of those peculiarities of investigative journalism. That being said, from a judge's perspective, it's not a good look.
In terms of keeping notes, I mean, there are a number of notes that were produced in, as part of the motion record. There were some questions in cross-examination that some answers suggested they weren't the entirety of the notes. One of the interesting things that came out in his affidavit, just like a little detail, was that one of the sources he met with came with some documents, not the documents showing this, but came with some documents as well as a Bic lighter, and indicated that he was planning to burn them at the end of their conversation after he went away. There was actually a line in the decision. So Perel observed that in the immediate case, it is conceivable that a court, meaning, you know, after a full trial, might decide that the defendants ought to have forgone the explosive March 2023 article about Dong's alleged advice to the Chinese consul general until the defendants had something more than the hearsay revelations of the confidential sources. I mean, what do you think about that, about the observation, like a judge's observation that, well, you could have just held off till you had more?
Yeah, the Supreme Court, I wish I could remember which case it comes from. The court has been reasonable in understanding that news is, and I'm quoting from one judgment, I wish I could remember which, the news is a perishable commodity. But within that whole idea of perishable commodities, we have to look at just how time sensitive a particular story is. So maybe a story of, you know, potential foreign interference weeks from a federal election, that's a tell it right now story. I don't have all the evidence before me, but from the outside looking in, it's hard to imagine there's nothing about that I can tell that letting this story kind of unfold for a few more days, a few more weeks, that it wasn't really going to change anything, you know, and was there a rush to publish? There's no denying that it looks damning when we have the Globe saying, yeah, we had the same stuff and we wouldn't go there. Perhaps that looks more damning than it should be, because again, back to different editorial decisions mm-hmm. being made. But that does add credence to the idea of why publish then? Was there more to be gotten on this? Could they have had a better case against Dong, or could they have had evidence that told them to kind of hold their fire with a bit more reporting? That's a big question. The judge puts an awful lot of emphasis on the whole, you know, this needs to see the full light of day. We need this matter to go to trial. Defamation suits don't go to trial. There's going to be a settlement. The terms are going to be confidential. I think that's where we will go. It would be wonderful to see this thing play out in a public courtroom. It would give us so much more public insight into investigative journalism processes. It would certainly shed light more on the how much intelligence is there in an intelligence report. I think it would even speak to the challenges individuals have in putting themselves out there in public office and the reasonable and unreasonable kind of challenges they face. I'd love for it to happen. I'd be in the front row with you watching this thing happen. It's not going to happen.
Lisa, on this show, we like to duly note things. I'd like to note, Julie, today that Julian Assange is free. It's finally happened. And those people who email us about why aren't you talking about Julian Assange and how he's in jail will maybe now stop emailing us, although maybe they'll take issues with my snarky comments here. He is back in Australia, heading to Australia after he was freed by a U.S. court. Yeah, he reached a plea bargain with the United States, pleading guilty to one count. He was sentenced to time already served. He spent the past 5 years or so in a jail in the UK, and he was able to register that plea in a court in Saipan, which is one of those places that I feel like I should have known where it was for the purpose of crossword puzzles and playing along with Jeopardy at home, but it's in the Northern Mariana Island, which is one of the U.S. territories I always forget about, and it hadn't even occurred to me that they have a U.S. federal courthouse there. So the Espionage Act has never been used by the U.S. before to pursue a publisher or journalist like Assange. And as part of his plea, he'll be required to store information provided to WikiLeaks. It was not clear if this was ever going to go to trial. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened and if that would have created a precedent one way or the other. But I also think that it's pretty clear that if you're publishing things that certain state actors don't want you to publish, they will find ways to go after you regardless of what the precedent on the books may or may not be.
Duly noted.
What would you like to note, Julie, today?
What I would like to note, Julie, perhaps because we're talking about investigative journalism here and it's kind of in the crosshairs at the moment when we assess this particular case. So I'd like to look more generally at a book that talks about the very best of Investigative Journalism, and that's Journalism for the Public Good by Kim Kearns. It's written in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Michener Deacon Awards. Okay. So this speaks to the Michener Awards and really does unpack some of the greatest journalism that has unfolded, investigative journalism that has changed policy, has changed law, has led to public inquiries, the stuff that really transforms us. And I appreciate what Kim is doing in this book, but what really got me on it was laudatory comment by Howard Law, who runs mediapolicy.ca and is a wonderful commentator on this. And he says in an awesomely plain-spoken way, and I'm going to adopt these words, okay? If after reading this book, you can't respond with respect and gratitude to journalists, buddy, you're a dead loss to humanity. So in the interests of not being a dead loss to humanity, I would like to duly note that Kim Kearns' book, Journalism in the Public Good, reminds us why so many of us got into this rat race in the first place.
Cool. Duly noted.
It calls itself North America's fastest growing newspaper, the Epoch Times.
The financial officer behind the far-right propaganda rag known as the Epoch Times has been indicted on allegations of a massive money laundering scheme.
So what the hell is the Epoch Times? If you have a bit, 40 minutes to answer that question, you can go back and listen to our 2020 episode that we produced called What the Hell is the Epoch Times? By our then producers, Tiffany Lam and Kasia Mihailovic. But if you don't have that time, then I do recommend you listen to it. And this is something that, I think half of the listeners will probably be like sighing, like, I know what the Epoch Times is by now. And the other half will be like, oh yeah, what the hell is that thing? It's been an odd fixture on the streets and on the computer screens of Canada, US, a big chunk of the world for the past couple decades. Lisa, what do you know about the Epoch Times?
I paid enough attention to see a pretty interesting kind of development in the Epoch Times. I know it's kicked around for about 20 years, that it is essentially a Falun Gong promotional publication designed, or was originally designed, to kind of present negative information or propaganda against the Chinese Communist Party. And then it found, just like True Love, this really interesting kind of allegiance with the right-wing politics of the U.S. and suddenly became very Trump-focused, Trump-centric. So I know that's what's going on there. I've never understood what's cause and what's effect. I've never understood what the real kind of ideological attachment is, or is this just a way to get more eyes on a publication?
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it's a very good question. Started as almost a newsletter / anti-Chinese Communist Party propaganda publication from Falun Gong, which is the Chinese government considers a cult, and which would say is at least a sect. It's a kind of, it's a practice. It's a quasi-religious sect.
Falun Dafa, also known as Falun Gong, is an advanced self-cultivation practice that improves mental and physical wellness through physical exercises and the development of one's character.
Which, has this sort of surprisingly successful media empire that sort of started with the Epoch Times, a television channel called New Tang Dynasty, as well as Shenyun, which is this ballet/performance troupe that seems to be everywhere all of the time.
Before communism, China had a glorious past. What if you could bring it back? Since 2006, Shenyun has been reviving the essence of Chinese civilization.
I mean, I wish every news outlet had a sort of an adjacent dance, theatrical, opera, performance troupe.
Be careful what you wish for. I want you to stop and think about that before you go too far. But okay, if you say that you think we should all have that, that's fine. It's confounding to me. Shenyun is confounding. This almost feels like a through the looking glass version of Amazon, that I can get the bags to pick up my dog poop from Amazon. They can send me my groceries and they can entertain me on TV tonight. I mean, what we have here are these three sister companies, one which is a propaganda/media organization, one which is kind of a traditional, with air quotes, song and dance review show. And then we have the faith-based aspect of what Falun Gong is, which, from the outside looking in, when you see peaceful people in a park moving so slowly and gracefully, I mean, it feels like a religion that, I don't know, if Gwyneth Paltrow didn't invent it, she could have. It's lovely. It's soft. It's elegant. We like elegance. So how these three fit together, it's They go together like nuts and gum. It's a strange, strange mix. I remember dragging my kid when I was still a Toronto person past those bright colored posters in the subway because I didn't want to go see that damn show. But it's ubiquitous. It is so part of kind of, I think, Toronto musicals for tourists. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, all over. Yeah, you see them in cities, you see posters for it in cities across North America, probably more often than you see posters for touring productions of Wicked. So the longtime CFO, the Epoch Times, Wei Dong Bill Guan, was charged by U.S. attorneys earlier this month with two counts of bank fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering. They allege that he basically embroiled or used the Epoch Times as part of this scheme involving fraudulently obtained employment insurance benefits, prepaid debit cards, and cryptocurrency, basically funneling money into the media company as a means to disguise its ill-gotten origins. When asked about it, would say, you know, this was subscription revenue or donation revenue or what have you. They also make a point of saying that, you know, these allegations do not concern the editorial or news gathering operations of the publications or outlets in any way. So that's, of course, set off a whole, you know, crisis that there are seemingly at the very least a shakeup at the publication. The CFO has been suspended. A few days later, the board accepted the resignation of the CEO, although we don't know exactly what his involvement may or may not have been, if any. They have an interim management team, and then the head of the Falun Gong movement is now, you know, has written a couple, they're like op-eds or editorials, which he seems to be chastising the publication and the people there for having jumped into partisan politics, notwithstanding the CCP stuff, but to jump into American partisan politics. Like, why are you doing all of this? It's a very strange series of events at a very strange publication. Have you been following any of this?
I have been following a good bit of it, and it is interesting because I'm trying to figure out this incredible increase in revenue. Was that the opportunity presented? Is that part of the theory of the case, which could be, well, hell, if there's so much more extra money coming in, mm-hmm. who's going to notice a few million here or a few million there? That certainly seems to be it. But there's so many things that just don't quite hang together here. I mean, I don't think we see too often where a senior executive in a corporation is working with members of a division within that corporation. And in this case, the division was known as the Make Money Online team.
Yes.
Which is just such a lousy name. You notice by taking the subject out, they skate safely there, right? It's like, who's making money online? Anyhow, we have a named corporate executive. We have an entire team of people working in that organization, yet the publication itself is not one of the named defendants. So that mm-hmm. is really interesting because that normally means that someone is acting well outside the scope of their kind of their workplace authority, which seems surprising. And then I'm not so surprised that we have someone closely related kind of admonishing this publication, mm-hmm. because if you look at its origin story, the idea is that it was, you know, it was created to kind of soft pedal this anti-communist party rhetoric, but also kind of as a kind of hearts and minds community engagement. And it was a publication dropped in communities all over the world at a time when so many other news organizations are kind of shutting down. So being in this very contested space of aligning with mm-hmm. kind of populist politics seems to run kind of stray from the, like, let's just get some good PR and also thump the Communist Party on its head. I don't quite get the confluence of all of this at the same time.
You read the op-ed from Li Hongxi, and he's basically, like, in his own sort of quasi-religious sect leader way, telling them to touch grass, as it were.
Which could really just be reading the room, that it's the yes. right thing to say at this time.
Said, many of you who are involved in various media platforms need to start connecting your work with raising awareness and helping to free people from danger to their souls. If your only aim is to increase your click rate, that's hardly the spiritual state of a Dafer practitioner. You are wasting large amounts of the limited time that is meant for rescuing people in these final days! You are going to regret that one day! Which is, I mean, it's a harsh thing to hear from, I don't know if he counts as their boss, but on the other hand, I don't know, that's good advice. Like, is good advice maybe all for all journalism. Like, is your work actually helping people? We're talking about this also because it has long had a fairly significant presence in Canada, offices in Canada. They have editions for many countries, but they definitely have stuff specifically, a lot of materials and a lot of things and content specifically targeting Canada. But one of the interesting things is how it has become a home for, or a home or at least a side gig for a lot of Post media columnists, some of the more prominent ones. They've been writing for them for several years. I mean, Conrad Black is actually one of their big names. He's written, from my account, 186 columns since the start of 2020. It's about 41 a year. Barbara Kay, also a longtime National Post columnist, 92 columns since 2019. It's about 19 a year. Anthony Fury was a longtime Sun editor, National Post podcast host, failed mayoral candidate in Toronto. He's written about 91 columns for them, first from starting November of 2022. Michael Taub, 56 columns since May 2022. Peter Menzies. These columns, like in many ways, they're not like necessarily like wacky things. I mean, many of them are, the headlines are such that, you know, you could imagine this being, you know, you can imagine it being like a John Ibbotson column, like most recent Conrad Black one is, "It is time for creative constitutional thinking on bilingualism and Quebec's place in Canada." But it is also a remarkable part of the strategy in the States as well to start bringing in prominent names. What do you think of this being the sidekick for a lot of prominent marquee National Post and Post Media columnists?
Certainly from the Epoch Times side of things, bringing in these kind of high visibility characters who are generally perceived as right of center, but not distressingly so, seems like such a wise move. What's in it for a Barbara Kay or a Conrad Black? I mean, I guess an e-transfer of whatever their standard column fee is right now. I can't see that there's anything there for them to get behind or get engaged with ideologically. And as you said, it's not as if the column focuses tend to be kind of, you know, connected to the front page news. I guess it's nice when journalists have another act. That's all I've got.
Yeah.
Beyond the remuneration, I cannot see a single thing that really works in the favor of a right-of-center Canadian columnist looking for somewhere to drop their byline in.
Beyond just the bank fraud allegations, which are, once again, not connected to the news-gathering operations, the heavy conspiracy theory leanings, the fact that it's published by a sect, it has always been an odd publication and all the thing out. Is it ethical, do you think, to write for them?
Ethical decisions, of course, are individual. I wouldn't want my byline in the Epoch Times, not in a heartbeat. There's a sufficiency of evidence that I think it's really okay to state plainly that this is a propaganda vehicle masquerading as a journalistic publication. I'm happy to go out on a limb and say that. If that's the case, I would say that all I'll do is tarnish my brand as a journalistic commentator or columnist if my work appears in those places. You know, the contrary view will be what matters is what I say in that space that I have for my 700 words, and that's what matters. But no, I'm not, it seems a little uncomfortable.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks for joining me, Lisa.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. You can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com if you'd like to complain about how fast I'm speaking or any other such things. People can also find me on Blue Sky these days. Where can people find you, Lisa?
I have not stepped onto Mastodon, Blue Sky, any of the new stuff, and I've left the mean old bird. So I'm email. That's about it. Makes it tougher. If you think I'm talking too fast, I'm harder to find.
And they can take your courses at King's University, I imagine.
I think that would be an excellent idea.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson and Sam Connert. Our production manager is Max Collins and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.
Achtung, Punkrock-Freunde, this is the Blurred Crusade, live on CJSF 90.1 FM.